Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Millennial Dentist Podcast. We're in the 80s now.
I think 80s something.
We're in the 80s. It is crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
I am so pumped tonight. This is something that I guess we've been wanting to have on for forever, and it is a incredible privilege to welcome Dr. Frank Spear. Doc, welcome to the podcast.
Whoop, whoop. Well, thanks, you guys. I'm looking forward to a delightful, probably, hour or so visiting? So.
I'd say that's probably what we could do. Did you ever think that you would be sitting here podcasting with a couple millennials?
There's a lot of things in dentistry I never thought I'd be doing.
So. I'd argue you've made it. You know, at this point, you know, if you didn't have enough notches on your belt already, I'd say that podcast with a couple millennials has got to be high up there.
No, it's good. Good.
Yeah, this is good. I'm glad because Sully brought this up. And I was like, you're talking about Spear? Because he said, Spear, you want to do this? And I'm like, who? And he's like, Frank Spear. I'm like, wait, are you sure? And he's like, yeah, it's him. I'm like, no, I want to. Is it really him? I'm like, yeah, he's going to be. So anyways, it's been honestly a privilege to have you on. There are tons and tons of people would love to hear this episode just because of, I'm sure, the name and the legacy.
Sure, of course.
So I wanted to kind of get in because we have only an hour with him.
We're jumping straight into content.
And I love how it's so funny because Sully's actually created the nice agenda for the first time. And I came in because I'm so nervous. I'm like, oh, what are we going to ask him? And what? So anyway, let's start with this. Talk about Frank in dental school, like from the journey, from the beginning. Why even dentistry? And then we're going to take that to a whole another level in the next hour.
So I won't take up a lot of time, but I think in order to answer your question, why dentistry, there's a real important story in my background that I love to share, and it actually has to do with one of the reasons I love teaching so much. So I grew up in a really small farming community about an hour south of Seattle. So there's about 1,500 people in the town. My dad owned a gas station. My mom was a second grade school teacher. They were born and raised in that town. I had no interest in dentistry whatsoever growing up. I mean, we had one dentist in the town. He was a great guy. I really liked him. He would come into the gas station and I would wait on him, but I had no bad experiences with dentistry, but I had I never would have seen myself as somebody who would even think about going to medical or dental school.
Sure.
So, because you guys are millennials, so this kind of stuff probably won't shock you. So my parents were big on education, and they had told me, this goes back to 1970, they said, okay, you have to go to college. Where are you going to go to college? And I was like, I don't know. I was interested in athletics. I played basketball, track, football.
Gotcha.
I was interested in girls, and I was interested in cars. That was just what you did during the day because you had to.
Exactly.
Sure. And so my parents said to me, look, you have to pick a college. You have to, you're going to college. I was their only child. So true story, 1970, Playboy magazine, cover photograph. Chico State, California is ranked the number one party school in America. I went home to my parents and I said, I'm going to apply to Chico State.
No way.
They never asked why. And I thought, it's a small enough school. I can still play football there. It's California. It's going to be fun. And so that's the only college I applied to, Chico State.
They were probably thinking, sitting there going, the fact that you showed any interest in college at all. They're like,
what happened? The only thing I hadn't planned on is I didn't get accepted.
Oh, wow. Come on.
Yeah.
Maybe that was a good thing, though. What happened next?
Oh, so exactly. So that leads to the answer of how I ended up in dentistry. So my parents kept saying, look, it's getting late. You have to go someplace. Well, they had both gone to local colleges, and my dad had gone to a place called Pacific Lutheran University. My dad says, why don't you go there? And I'm like, wow, that doesn't sound remotely like a party school.
The complete opposite of my state.
But I applied there and I got in, and And I literally spent my freshman year of college trying to convert Pacific Lutheran University into Chico State. So I ended up my year with a 2.3 GPA. I got a D in a religion class.
Wow.
A private school. My parents did not have a lot of money and they were paying for it. And when I finally got home my first year and they're like, you can't do this. You cannot go to this school and get D's and 2.3.
No.
Or we can't pay for you to go there. So when I went back, with summer of 72, they said, you have to pick a major. You got to decide what you're going to do. And all of my football buddies, because I was playing football there, all my football buddies were physical education majors. They wanted to be coaches. And the hardest classes, if you were a phys ed major, was anatomy and physiology. And I thought, heck, I'm just going to take it, get them done, and then I'll enjoy my last 2 years just having fun.
Sure.
So I signed up for an anatomy class in the fall. Fall of 72. And it's a really small school, so there's only 17 students per teacher. So I'm in this small anatomy class, and I'm having fun, and I'm doing well, and I'm liking it. And at the end of the class, this teacher, her name was Ruth Sorensen, and she'd had polio as a child. So she had leg braces and arm braces. She was just passionate about anatomy. And at the end of the semester, she comes to me and she says, next week after finals, I'd like to meet with you in my office. And I thought, man, I thought I've been doing good in this class. I don't know why she'd want to meet with me. And so I finish finals and I go into her office and she's sitting there waiting, sit across the desk from her. And this woman looked at me and she says, what are you going to do with the rest of your life?
Wow.
And I said, I'm going to be a coach. She says, yeah, that's what I thought. So what else have you thought about? Nothing. She says, you ever think about being a physician? No. Dentist? No. Veterinarian? No. Physical therapist? No. She says, well, I think you should. She said, so I've set up a meeting for you and I. And we got up and we walked about 30 feet down the hallway of the science building. And she had set up a meeting with the pre-med, pre-dent advisor. His name was Harold Laris. He was a dentist.
Wow.
Nice. The two of them sat at the desk with me. And 15 minutes later, I said, I'm going to be a dentist.
That is crazy.
That's how I ended up in dentistry.
Wow.
It's amazing how you look back on stuff like that, and how one or two people can be that influential in, obviously you've been successful, but beyond successful, and to go from essentially, where you're borderline, are you going to even make it in school?
Right. Right.
That is just fascinating.
To changing dentistry in a way that it's never been practiced. So just the power of influence.
And so I tell that story because for me, the reason education and teaching is so important to me is I believe, and I even tell myself before I ever walk on stage, let me be Ruth Sorensen today for somebody in this room.
Wow.
Let me help somebody in this room to believe something different about themselves, because that's what she did. She said to me, hey, you can do more. You just don't think you can do more, but you can do more. So it was transformational for me. So that's okay. So then after that, I got 1B the rest of my time in college. Didn't believe I should really, I figured everybody that got in dental school had parents that were dentists and they'd wanted to be dentists since they were like 2 years old. And so I applied to 12 dental schools because I figured nobody would want me. So I literally applied to 12 dental schools, hoping somebody would say yes. And then
also from the previous experience, that was not a good idea.
Exactly. You were 0-for-1.
Yeah, exactly. So I got into UW and I did really well there. And while I was there, I really fell in love with Perio Pross. And so I got out of dental school in 79, went in and did my Perio Pross program in 80, finished that in 82. And then, if you kind of wonder, how did I get from there to here? It's another series. It's these influential things that happen in life.
Sure.
So while I was in my Perio Pross program, we had a year-long class on how to give a presentation, and it was every week for an hour. And your final exam was you had to present an hour presentation to the faculty of the restorative department. And so I did my hour presentation, and one of the faculty happened to be a man who had been running study clubs in Seattle for about 25 years. His name was Jerry Schultz. And he saw my presentation and he said to me, so this would have been 81. And he said to me, you know, next summer, in summer of 82, I'm having a big reunion of all my study club members from 25 years. Would you come do an hour presentation for me?
Wow.
Yeah.
And so I, sure, what do I know? So I finish my program, I start practice. July of 82 comes along. I go do this hour presentation, and sitting in the audience was a fellow who was the program chairman for the American Academy of Fixed Prosthodontics. Back then, it used to be called the American Academy of Crown and Bridge Prosthodontics. And he comes up to me and he says, you know, I'm the program chairman for this meeting next February in Chicago. Would you come do that hour for us?
Wow.
Sure.
So you weren't even, you had just basically graduated residency.
I was a month out of my grad program.
Wow.
When I did the first one. So I did the hour program in February of 83. It's a funny story. It was a 2-day meeting, Saturday, Sunday, and I was on the second day. And the opening speaker was Vic Lucia, that invented the Lucia jig. And the title of his talk was A 30-Year Retrospective on Prosthodontics. And the reason I remember it so clearly is my 30th birthday was the day after my lecture. So I literally started my lecture by saying, you know, Dr. Lucia started yesterday by doing a 30-year retrospective on prosthodontics, and I can't do that because tomorrow's my 30th birthday.
I'm going to give you my 30th retrospect on life.
And then, yeah. And honestly, then what happened was, I don't know, there's probably 4, 5, 6 people came up at the end of that meeting and said, hey, would you come do a day for us next year?
And so
happened.
Let me interrupt you there a little bit and step back just a second, because, you know, one question we get all the time is, you know, when you graduate dental school and you go into, you know, the residency program. And my first question is, you obviously said you had a love for it. You know, we talk a lot of times that, you know, a lot of times in dental undergrad, your experience with perio specifically is a pretty negative, and pros too, like those end up being like the two classes that most people don't like, that you're trying to survive. And you know, is it something that you just saw kind of that it was beyond scaling, replaning and mounting casts, or did you just have, again, influential people that kind of made
I had the director of our grad perio pros programs, a man named Ralph Udalis, and he was really famous back in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And Ralph, he was so inspirational at showing you what could be done. Mm-hmm. And we had a great chairman of perio, Bill Ammons, and we just had great faculty. And they really made me really get psyched about what you could do in perio pros. Wow. So it wasn't the topic probably as much as the influential instructors that they said, this is what's possible.
Right.
And I was like, wow, I had no idea. So that was really the motivation, I think, more than the topic
itself. One thing I like, because you mentioned this, Solik, and it is true. And I think a lot of it also goes back to the trends and what's going on in that era. For example, perioprost back in 70s, 80s are not perioprost in 90s and early 2000s. No. Right now, we are also, I feel like 2019 perioprost is different than 2017 period. Like, we are so fast changing with the technology, with everything that has been added to our industry, that it is controlling so many things. And that's why right now I felt like one of the reasons that, for example, I get this question a lot too, like all the time on my Instagram, on Facebook, everywhere, that, hey, I see you doing this, but you didn't go to PROS. Why should I go to PROS? Right. Why should I do this? Because when I see you, I want to do this, for example. And I'm not really bragging or anything. I'm just saying this is what I'm getting all the time, because these dental students are thinking, is it worth 3 years? Is it worth 4 years to do this surgery? And next thing I know, I'm like, at first I didn't know what to say, really. Like, I'm like, if you really want to do that, do that. But here's my story. And my story is very much just like yours. The very beginning, Soli knows, everybody knows, with my journey was started with
people.
with a lot of influential Dr. Picos's and Tarnow's and Dr. Koi's and Dr. Salama's and a lot of those folks where I was like, oh my God, you can do this. And that's what, it wasn't really what they were doing. It was just what they were really showing the passion of, look at what I collected for these years. And that's where to me feel like, oh my God, the power of influence and education. Mm-hmm. So it's really not a question of you, is it better for this? To be honest, it's a personality. It's more of a who do you really...
And we mentioned routinely that, you know, because we didn't do that,
uh-huh.
and we aspire to do a lot of,
sure.
you know, more specialty type procedures, right. that the two of us have had to learn.
So
we're learning
more.
A lot more on our mistakes.
Right.
Because we didn't have, you know, because we didn't have that kind of training.
But also, another thing is also, I feel like to me is always, if I'm not a specialist, I need to be so much better than a specialist.
Sure.
In my mind, that if I am offering this treatment of 30,000, 40,000, then I have to be so good. So that also pushes this thing in my subconscious mind of, I got to be so good at what I do, and the power of like the CEs and meeting more and more people. Yeah. So for me, it worked in a better way than if I, for example, took 3 years off and it turned out to be 30 out of school. For me, I would have not probably been where I'm at right now. But is that true for everybody? I don't think so. I mean, that's maybe not true. So that's one thing I wanted to really go over. Some of people ask that a lot.
And Doc, I want to ask you this question because I had to ask this to Alan to kind of ask later, but we're here now. So let's just kind of, I would like to jump into it if that's okay with you. You know, Payman and I talk a lot about where, and maybe it's just that we feel this way. And, you know, correct me if you think it's more of just a trend or if it's more of just, we all think that way and then we all learn. But, you know, it seems to be that the competition in dentistry today from corporate dentistry or, you name it, you know, the fact that we're not getting reimbursement rates, that to be successful, it makes a lot of sense to, you know, keep things in-house or to go beyond the spectrum of just, you know, typical bread and butter dentistry. Now, obviously, you're a huge believer in a multidisciplinary approach, and Payray and I both have started to... We're huge followers, and you know, and yourself, and you know, Payman's are doing Dr. Koi's, but one of the things we've tried to do is try to learn a number of these, you know, the different disciplines, and try to do a lot of that under one roof. And so, my question is: do you see that being a trend that we're going to see more of that, more of the GP trying to bring that in, or do you think that's more of a unique thing, or just a time and space? Kind of talk about that a little bit.
Good point.
Well, for sure, I would probably say I think it's a trend. And I think that you're probably going to see more of it. And my own bias about it, you know, as an educator, and as you mentioned, you know, we focus very heavily on an interdisciplinary approach to what we do with, you know, the study clubs we have, et cetera. But on the same token, if you have general practitioners that are very competent at doing those procedures, I would take the approach of, it's to me important that whoever the clinician is, whether you're a general practitioner or a specialist, if you recognize that there's something that is outside of your comfort zone, those are the cases that probably need to be sent out, not experimented on.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean that you can't be a general practitioner and doing a lot of procedures that in the past would have typically been seen more as a referral to a specialist. I do think that the interesting aspect of it economically, because you mentioned keeping things in-house.
Sure.
There, and I'll just use my own example. Because when I started practice, I used to practice 6 days a week initially, and I used to work out of three different offices. And I used to try and do a lot of things myself.
Sure.
For the same reason that you would probably think of, well, if I send that out, it's like sending money out the door.
Sure, exactly.
But over time, as I got busier and busier, and I had more patients who were really seeking out what I wanted to do, which was essentially fixed froth, it became obvious to me that actually if I sent more out, it opened up room in my schedule for me to have more of what I wanted to do.
More fun.
And in that case, it's more fun and more profitable.
And more economical, exactly.
Yeah. But if on the other hand, sending it out opens up space, but you don't have something to fill it, then for sure, keeping things in-house, I get the economics of it.
What's funny? Go ahead.
No, So I think your question is, yes, that's going to become more and more common. But I do think as you find the things that you really enjoy, that you have the most fun with, and that you feel like you're most competent at, that regardless of what it is that you might send out, whether it's third molars or endo or whatever, if that sending that out allows you to do more of what you really like doing the most, to me, you know, our business really, what we tell people is real simple. Our business exists for four reasons. Our number one reason that Spirit Education exists is to try and help dentists have more fun.
Yeah.
I can tell you if a dentist is having fun, they're doing better dentistry, they're treating patients better, they're treating team better, they're more fun at home with their family. And so we want dentists to have more fun. Our second reason for existing is we want dentists to be more profitable. Because if a dentist isn't profitable, they're stressed.
Sure.
And when a dentist is stressed, they're not having fun. And they're also, if they're not profitable, they're also really not able to present treatment freely. There's a pressured need the patient to say yes.
Correct.
Third reason we exist is to try and help dentists have more free time. There are dentists that are working an awful lot of hours and aren't profitable in the process of working all those hours. So having more fun, being more profitable, and having more time off, those would be our kind of three of our four primary goals.
And those are also my three goals.
Yeah. And you know, the fourth goal.
You sound very millennial.
It's how you get there. Is we want to help dentists grow clinically, because when a dentist grows clinically in their competence and their confidence, those other three things happen.
Totally.
So education gets a dentist there by growing their confidence and confidence. But man, you know, when I got out of school, I thought dentists that were interested in money were bad dentists. And then I realized if you're not interested in paying attention to money, you're not helping anybody because you're totally stressed all the time.
Sure. It is so funny because it's so interconnected and everything is that you do. Like you said, those three things come in hand. Like if you don't have one of them, you're not going to have that office. And another thing that I feel like is also important, and I'm seeing it more and more, is not only the education of these, like especially now that I'm being more of a speaking and doing things with these people I'm following up, is one thing that I'm noticing is the team. And that whole team of pushing the dentist to do the more and have that vision of, hey, it's not really for the dentist, but it's for us. And that's what also for me personally, my practice, my new smile, it's helping me do so much more dentistry, because when I see my team is so psyched up and excited about what I want to do, they are also pushing me to do more. So it used to be back way, like, hey, I was trying to push them. Now they are so into it that they're so,
So, you know, it's funny you say that. I thought that answer was really fitting, Dr. Spear, from the standpoint of, you know, when I graduated, one of the first things I did was I went and took 6 months miles. Because I was like, you know, dad doesn't do any ortho. I don't know any patients. Like, I'm going to start doing some dentistry that dad doesn't do. It's different. So they're like, I can put money on the table. Mm-hmm. And when you're, you know, when you're just graduating dental school, you know, someone walk in with a molar root canal and I'd be like, well, guess what? I got 6 hours to do it because I don't have anybody on the schedule, right?
That's right.
To your point of the schedule thing.
Yeah.
But then what happens is you get better at things, you do more dentistry, you find the things you like. And for me, I found that one, I realized that, gosh, that type of ortho is limiting in a lot of aspects. I don't enjoy it that much. And so for me, it became, you know, and then I took courses, you know, certain things like facially generated treatment planning, where all of a sudden I realized how much I could gain from the specialist and, you know, in areas where I didn't succeed. So like, you know, that's an area where like I use them a ton in an interdisciplinary approach. You know, I've found just like you that like there's certain aspects of surgery that I love to do, you know, so I may do more of that aspect. but I still then refer a ton to, you know, sure. Perio, where, you know, that's an area.
But that's also a luxury of when you entered this practice of where it was established. Like, for example, there were patients
sure,
coming
exactly.
in. It, your mindset, like, look at how you've come from the 6 months
oh,
to now what you're doing. So,
well, it's better about, dentistry too.
Right. Now. Not only that, but also look at how much changes from what you started to what you're doing now versus some of these students and some people that are asking, hey, what should I do? It is so difficult to tell them what to do because when I feel like going back after graduation, I was not even zero. I was so negative. I didn't even know what I wanted to do. Like, I had no idea why am I in affordable dentures when I hated dentures. And I'm here looking at dentures where I'm like, this is the one thing I hated in dental school. I'll have to work here because I need a job to pay off my debt. So it is so clinical. Like, you got to have some time, I feel like, right out of school to examine and not, like, right away go and try to buy practice and try to do this because that might also be different for maybe it changes. So doing something like you did or going to some of these corporates, the DSOs, I feel like that's a great way of learning, hey, do I like ortho? Do I like this? Or do I like some of that stuff before either pursuing residency or going and opening up your own practice.
No, I totally agree. And to that point,
I feel like I answered it instead of being mad. No. Sorry, but
okay, Dr. Spears, so let's get back on. Let's go back to okay. So you have now you know, you're starting to travel and do this. You're starting to do more speaking and that sort of thing. Let's focus. Let's switch a little bit back over to now your practice. So when you graduated residency, you go into practice. Were you by yourself? Were you with people? Talk about your practice life a little bit.
Yeah. So if we go back to June of 82, which is when I finished, interest rates were running around 19 to 20% if you wanted to actually open an office. And they were worse in 79 when I got out of dental school, like 21%.
Wow.
So there was, and I had been divorced my last year in grad school. So I needed to work and there was no way I was opening an office.
Yeah. Wow. That's even more percentage than the 20.
Yeah. you had 50%.
Yeah. It's pretty bad, huh?
It's not so good.
So what I did, it was good for me what I did. So I worked 6 days a week. On Mondays, I rented space from a periodontist who worked in probably one of the most affluent communities in the Seattle area. And her patients, most of them could write a check for the dentistry.
Wow.
And so on Mondays, the only patients I saw came from her, but she couldn't take patients away from her referrals on a regular basis. So I wasn't busy. But the patients I saw, my case presentation percentage was probably 100% because she'd already told them everything about me, told them roughly what problems would be. I walk in, introduce myself, come up with a treatment plan, tell them the amount, and they just pretty much say, okay, when do we start? Mm-hmm. So that was Mondays. On Fridays and Saturdays, I rented space from two periodontists over on the Olympic Peninsula in the state of Washington, which is where the naval base is. And it's much more remote than Seattle area. So I rented space from them Fridays and Saturdays. And I saw a lot of military families. And they, again, came from the two periodontists. So they were set up well, but they didn't have the economics. So the good news was it really taught me about how to phase treatment. Mm-hmm. Because I had people who really wanted to do the dentistry. They just couldn't afford the dentistry. Mm-hmm. And so on Fridays and Saturdays, I had a much more challenging time of getting people to say yes. And I would end up doing small segments and not the stuff I was doing on Mondays. But that still left. So I was working basically as a fixed prostodontist out of three periodontist offices, if you will. But that left Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday that I wasn't doing anything. And my family dentist in my small town of 1,500, he said to me, look, you need to work. Why don't you come be my associate? And he got out of dental school in 1943.
Wow.
So this is 1982. So he's been in practice 39 years then.
Wow.
And I was like, you're right. I need to work. So I went and worked in the small town I grew up in as an associate for the general practitioner who had been my family dentist on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. Oh my God. And as you can imagine, if you'd been in practice 39 years and you had some young associate, you're going to give them everything you don't want to do.
Yes.
So that's exactly what he did. He gave me everything he didn't want to do, which meant six-year-olds that were screaming.
And
take anything he didn't want to do, he sent me, and I had to cover all the emergencies.
I never thought about Dr. Spear the Hustler. You know, 6 days a week.
So did you do 6 days for like 2 weeks or three?
Yeah. Dr. Spear the Hustler. I had a lab in my home I was renting, and I was doing all my own lab work as well. I had no life at all. And during that time, in 83, a group of 8 dentists came to me at the office in my little town. A group of 8 dentists from Tacoma, Washington came and said, hey, would you mentor a study club on aesthetics for us? And aesthetics back then was not a real common thing. I mean, sure. You know, nothing like what you think of it today. And so I said, yeah, I'll do that. So I started mentoring this study group of 8 people, and we would go at 1 o'clock. I would do a lecture for a couple hours. They would bring patients in. I would do some demos, or they would treat patients and I would oversee them. And that really became fun for me. So that started taking up, I started taking like a half a day off a month from practice to go to that. By 84, 3 more study clubs had asked if I'd mentor them. So I had 4 by 84. I think by 85, I had 7. So I was doing 7 half a days a month.
Wow.
Of mentoring study clubs and then practicing. And yes, I was still practicing 6 days a week.
That is awesome. But how did you get this to do these? Like, for example, because you just got out of school 82, correct? Residency.
Correct. So yeah.
From 82, you said you started doing this. Now, how do these people know of you? Because there's no social media, there's no Facebook, there's nothing back then. So what
Our graduate program's reputation was so powerful program.
I see.
And nobody from our program was in the entire state of Washington south of Seattle. So I was the only person in the whole state south of Seattle that had got out of our program. There was only one other prosthodontist, period, south of Seattle back then. Wow. And so these people knew that I'd gone through that program, and that was what motivated
them. The invitations, because I'm like, how is he getting invited like 2 years out? And that's good to know. That's awesome.
Okay, so keep going. So this is how, so basically a lot of this was, you know, organic in nature. And as the study clubs start arising and kind of, you know, you're doing that, did at any point you, when did the 6 days, how did that kind of stop?
Yeah. So the dentist that my family dentist, he decided to retire in June of 85.
Okay.
And so at that point, I was still working the Monday through Saturday thing and mentoring the study clubs. But John Coys had been a year behind me in grad school. And John and I had gotten along really well as grad students. And when John got out of school, he had to go give the Air Force 3 years. And so he was coming up on when he was going to leave the military when he was down in Mississippi. And we'd always talked about, you know, it'd be fun to practice together. So, you know, I was working out of those other offices, but I realized that the practice in the small town was actually a gold mine.
Sure.
Because there's so much dentistry that had never been presented. Mm-hmm. Because my family dentist was a great operative dentist, but he was a single tooth dentist.
Right.
And so John and I had stayed in touch. And so in 85, John and I bought the building and John bought the practice from him. I had already kind of built up a good following of mine, so I kept my practice. And then John and I joined in 85 and pretty much... By then I was starting to also travel more for lecturing. And so I cut the 6 days a week pretty much went away somewhere around that 85, 86 era. But then I really started traveling and speaking a lot more. So by, I'd say 87, 88, 89, I was probably speaking 80 to 100 days a year on the road.
Wow.
Plus, we had grown the study club business. I think John and I, by 87, we had 11 study clubs.
Wow.
For mentoring. A half a day a month, and we would both go to those. So it was, we worked a lot.
So selfishly, I have to ask this question because, you know, Perry and I both are getting the opportunity to do more and more, you know, speaking and traveling and et cetera. You know, how do you balance that? You know, because obviously you enjoy it, you love it, and we've kind of felt the same way. Like, gosh, we love this. But at the same time, you know, there's this barrier of like, okay, well, the practice still pays the bills. Yeah. You know, as that kind of goes, just any good tips there, pointers?
Yeah, I think, you know, somebody asked me this like last week, and it's, I don't have a good answer. I don't know that I did it well, to be honest.
Sure.
I don't. I was gone a lot. I mean, at the peak of my busyness, I would practice Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday till 3, drive to the airport, fly someplace Wednesday night, speak Thursday. Fly someplace else Thursday night, speak Friday. Fly someplace else Friday night, speak Saturday.
Wow.
Come home Saturday night if I could make it home from the East Coast, which I usually couldn't. Or that means Sunday morning, and then repeat the process. And I was doing that probably 2 times a month, those 3-day trips, along with the practice and along with study clubs. And it takes a toll.
When you said, I think that's also important to know that, like, for some of these people, like young educators that want to do these, because we do get so many messages from even young specialists, right? Like, they wanted to get into that field. But
it's not all flash.
Right. But what is happening is that, if to me, I feel like, honestly, personally, in my experience, when I built my office from scratch, and it's me, and if I'm not in the practice,
that suffers.
So, and if I'm going to Thursday, Friday speaking or doing something, I'm losing money. Not only that, but also Monday morning. Yeah. Do you think for a minute my team members are going to remember what to do? Because it's been 5 days I haven't worked. So for me, it was like, I'm saying a lot of no's these days just because I want to get my new small, my practice in a level where now it's running on its own. I have GPs that are working, but then I can do this. So I think with yours also having
it's a huge help.
Having an associate or somebody, your dad, or with, I think, was it John that also run, like, did you guys do these speaking together at the same time, or were they, somebody was keeping the doors open and keeping the appointments? Because that's
like, we were pretty much independent in terms of our speaking stuff. So, you know, especially through the late 80s, the office was, and we did bring in an associate in 86, I think, or 87. So we did have some other people in the practice. Nice. But I can tell you, if I was to look back on it, if you come up with a certain number of days that you can limit yourself to and stick to it, because it's addictive,
say
right?
No, it is.
No, you have to say no. It's addictive. I mean, you know, it's like you start loving doing it, and you love in the recognition, acknowledgement, and it's like a fix. And the trouble is, it's easy to just, as long as you keep saying yes, it's easy to get sucked into the vortex.
My wife sat me down last week, and I have a 6-month-old. And she was like, you gotta put the brakes a little bit here. She's like, I know you love it. And you know, that's the problem, is like, it's such a fortunate thing to be in a profession where we love what we do and love being able to, like, we're so fortunate to have that, because not everybody has that kind of job, you know, where they get to love what we do.
It is. It's like, I mean, I'm checking my voicemails and then Instagram messages at 9 o'clock. My eyes are like so shut down, and I'm seeing so many.
Because you're still working.
And I feel bad of not answering. And I'm like, at the same time, I'm at a dinner table with these people, and I can't, like, it's just so much.
It's hard to unwind.
And also with you guys, because I feel like, honestly, with what you guys created, that whole study club mentality of mentorship is the same thing that is going on in a worldwide virtual world of doing with Instagram, or having a whole conference out of it that we did with the DIA, bringing people from Australia's and different parts of different continents. And it's like, it's funny when I hear his story, I'm like, they did the same thing, but in a whole lot harder in Washington state, where now people. I can be on, like, sitting down and talking with my friends every night. Like, so it's like, salute and cheers to you guys for doing this and paved the way for a lot of us to take advantage of these millennials. So that's why this podcast is about a lot of us seeing what they did with how much hassle, working days. and being who where he is. So, Ren, I don't want to forget this. I know Sully didn't put this in the agenda, but I do want to bring this up because it is important for a lot of folks. You have a book on treatment plan. It's a case acceptance, something about a case acceptance on Amazon. I bought this about, it's funny because I just remember as you were talking about presenting treatment plans, I was going to mention it, but I let you finish. But then, so I bought this book 3 years ago, and this is...
What's the book called, Dark Spirit?
Can I get the actual... It's a...
Now, you want me to look it up on Amazon?
I think it's The Art of True Planning or something.
No, it's something... Art of Case Presentation? It's a blue book. It's a blue book. It's small... Yeah,
I'm embarrassed that I cannot tell you that.
We'll look it up.
But let me tell you this, because as a reader,
we'll have it posted in the notes.
As somebody who read this on a plane ride, and like it's actually a short read, so it's like about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But what I read about his mentality back then, because this book was written a long time ago, right? And you have cases from your own case that you were showing, Jack and Jill. And it's so funny because for anybody that likes to really get into the mindset of what do I need to present to these people? When I read this book, it kind of changed my also philosophy of when I'm sitting down with Jack and Jill's and all these people, what is going on through their head as they're looking at me? And that book is great. Can you mention a little bit of some of these arts and techniques that you've learned quite a bit in the, in the past that helps a lot of people presenting these?
Because that's, I'd argue, probably the one of the number one stumbling blocks for young
Oh my gosh, especially younger ones with the lack of communication skills. And that's why...
So I'll give you just a few thoughts. The first thing I would tell you is, and really the heart of the book is in terms of the style of how you communicate with the patient. Mm-hmm. And pretty much what we talk about is that traditionally there's sort of three styles of how a physician or a dentist presents treatment. There's what we'll call the authoritarian style, which is the classic model of medicine from centuries ago, where literally you go to the doctor examines you and says, you've got it, I can fix it, $5,000.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole presentation. And that doesn't fly in today's world.
They tell them what they need.
Yeah, you tell them what they need. And the second model is kind of what most dentists do. I call it the scarcity treatment planning model. The dentist looks at the patient and goes, well, they really could benefit from 6 restorations or 7 restorations, but I just met them and I'm afraid if I tell them they need 7 restorations, they're going to run out the door.
I'll tell them 2
I'll tell them 2. And then you tell them 2 and then you sit back and watch their face.
Yeah.
And if they don't look upset, you go, oh, I should have told them 3. Right? And so you base what you present on your fear of how you think they'll react or whether they'll say yes or not.
Insurance, kind of the way, insurance-driven dentistry.
Yeah.
How much is the insurance paying? And then, right. Who cares? But like, that's exactly, And then what's the third one, which is my favorite?
So the third one was really developed by Bob Barkley back in the 1960s and 70s, and he called it co-diagnosis. And co-diagnosis is you don't present a treatment plan. Instead, for each problem, you present the findings. So let's say you have a tooth that's cracked. You present, let me show you the picture of your cracked tooth. So you make them aware they have the problem first. Then secondly, you tell them, let me tell you what's most likely going to happen if you don't do anything. So you tell them the consequences of having the problem next. And then you say, now, if we were to do treatment, this is how treatment would help this tooth. So you still haven't told them a treatment plan. So you tell them what the problem is that you found. You tell them what the consequences are if they don't treat it. You tell them how the prognosis changes if you did treat it. And then you look at them and say, is this something you'd be interested in hearing about? Mm-hmm. And if they say yes, what they're really doing is they're asking you to give them a treatment plan. What you're essentially doing when you tell somebody that you need treatment, you're telling them what you want to do. And then you follow it up typically by trying to explain why you want to do it.
Yep.
What we're doing is the exact opposite.
Correct.
We're just saying what co-diagnosis does is it tells them why you might want treatment before you ever talk about what treatment is.
So good.
So you give them, it's how you motivate your team.
Right.
You can give your team a why reason for what you want them to do before you tell them what you want them to do. You can give them the why. They're much more likely to engage in wanting to do it. when you tell people what to do and then you try and explain why you want them to do it, people tend to resist. So the heart of the book would be that. And then a few really, I think, important takeaways that you mentioned. A couple of things about the patient's headspace. We try in the book to talk a lot about, so what is the attitude of the patient as you're thinking of presenting treatment? Are they worried about the fact that they need to be at another appointment in 20 minutes? Do they have a kid to pick up? Do they have, because if there's all those other things interfering in their headspace, it's not probably going to go well to present treatment.
Yep.
And a big part of it, especially for anything that's larger amounts of dentistry, let's say it's 4 units, 6 units, 8 units, whatever. On those cases, if that's a new patient exam, that patient may not be prepared to hear what you're about to say.
Sure.
But if you actually say to them, you know, what I'd like to do is organize my thoughts, get some photographs, and have you back, because there's some things I'd like to go over with you so that you can make a good decision for yourself. When you bring a person back for a second appointment, they actually come in the headspace of expecting to hear something they didn't ever hear before because you brought them back. So if you look at just the success rates of bringing people back that have larger amounts of dentistry to have a separate presentation and a separate appointment, a big reason why it's so much more effective is the headspace the person comes in.
Wow.
With. They're so ready.
Not even necessarily anything other than them being more.
They're just ready to hear. They're in a totally different place to be able to hear what you're trying to say.
Well, it makes sense. If they've been sitting there for an hour getting their teeth cleaned and they're exhausted, they're ready to go.
And I love this. And don't get me wrong. I tried this. I have tried both of being so clinical, so clinically educated that whenever I see them, I do everything, especially with what we have, Trios scanner and the 3D printer and the pictures from everything's already taken. And when I'm walking in, it doesn't take much time for me, especially because the way that I practice right now, or maybe the model of my office is everybody comes in knowing they have all of these problems because they haven't seen a dentist for 10, 15 years. I felt it works better in my office if I give them right away, this is how much, and this is going to be $300 a month. So I'll do the treatment plan presentation about 30 minutes, 20 minutes right away in the consult room while they're chilling and then watching all the videos of all our cases. They're watching testimonials. And then I go back with saying, hey, this is what we're going to do. This is the problem. And all of everything with the co-diagnosis after I read, doing that, and then having my girls while I'm doing this to do the care credit Green Sky and not come back and say this is $40,000, but hey, this is $300. How would you like to pay for that? There is no reason for paying, telling people. And that's when our strategy. And I'm learning this from Crabtree, right? Like, our acceptance rate is going up and I'm learning more. So this is what he does. And this is what it's been working, where they are coming back and they say, let's close. And they're there. They made an appointment, especially with these days and the scheduling and how crazy it is to just get people from all these places to come to your office, where if you can tell them, hey, this is going to be, for example, $300, and they're like, well, how much is the total? And then you don't even tell them, well, first you say, hey, this is going to be $300, and then you watch them what they say. Because if they are going to be, most of the time, well, how much is it going to be? How much is the cost? And then you say, would you like it? They don't even tell them how much then. They still say, would you want me to make it more affordable than $300? Then they're like, no, I just want to pay cash. Then you're like, okay, well, this is going to be this much. And then you just wait and pause and see what they react. And then based on that, you're just going to follow. However, I've learned that if you do a good job on have this whole system structured from the time of intake calls, people calling the office and having, are you going to pay for this? Because if Miss Jones, if you haven't seen a dentist for 10, 15 years, you got so much problems and this is going to cost you a lot of money. So are you prepared to have financing or who's paying for this? And if there is somebody paying for it, bring them with you. And I felt like if you do that all very coordinated first day, the acceptance rate goes up so much more where they don't have to.
Yeah, but the difference, I think you're totally right in one respect, but I think the difference is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Spear, but there's two types of patients.
Correct.
There's one type of patient who's like, it's all about their headspace, right? Sure. Like they're mentally, they're there. Because in what you're marketing towards and a lot of your stuff are these people who know they're a train wreck.
Correct.
Where a lot of times you have a patient who they just want to get their teeth cleaned. They don't realize that they have a bunch of problems or potential problems or wear or whatever.
You don't want to shock them.
And so their mindset is totally not there that mm-hmm. day. So that's where I kind of see both sides because, you know, yeah, some people mentally, their headspace is there. They're ready to make a move, which you're capitalizing on to some degree. But some people, if you try to do that all that same day at their hygiene appointment, it would maybe freak them out. But is that what you're thinking, Doctor? Where are you thinking?
I totally agree with everything you just said. Both of you, actually. My own kind of model is for most general practitioners, I think because the general practitioners have one, they have some real advantages compared to specialists in that you have a recall system, mm-hmm. and that's a security blanket the specialists don't have.
Right.
But what a specialist has that makes their life easier to some extent is they have a filter. And the filter is that they've got a label on the door that says, I'm a periodontist, I'm an endodontist, I'm an orthodontist. So people go in their office for certain reasons. For general practices, the challenge is you get people coming in for all kinds of different reasons. So I kind of try and tell students, you know, in reality, you could think of having almost three separate new patient experiences. You can have the consult for the person that just has one tooth they want to talk to you about and give them 20 minutes. Yep. You can have the traditional exam where they come in, there's an exam, there's hygiene, mm-hmm. And that's a patient who basically has been seeing a dentist, you know, fairly routinely. Or, and this is where I agree with what you're saying, Perry, is you can have a comprehensive patient who knows they have significant problems. And one of the things that Gary DeWood, one of our faculty, mm-hmm. what his receptionist used to do is she would specifically ask patients, do you think you're having any significant dental issues right now? And if they would say yes, mm-hmm. that patient would actually get appointed for an hour and a half to 2 hours. They would get all the records. He would present everything that appointment because, in fact, they knew they had a problem. So I think what your dividing line is exactly right. When I was talking about the bringing people back, I'm talking about people who have no idea they have a problem. They yeah. think they're fine, you know, yeah. and you're about to drop a bomb on them and right. they have yeah. no idea you're going to drop the bomb.
So in other words, what I'm also learning is the intake calls are so important.
So important.
Because that's the first line that these yeah. people are trying to connect with you.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how much that's. This is my mindset.
Well, you weren't
right?
even taking the call. I mean, we don't know what happens on the phone.
No, not only that, but I'm also this. I'm like, Jennifer, everybody that calls, you got to get them in, and I'll fix it. Don't worry. As long as I see them, I have their. I can.
You're
I
thinking.
Can,
you're right. Right.
I can transform their lives because I done it in a way that some people that came from gas station paying me $35,000 for treatment because of the emotional value of what I showed them, thinking, hey, this got so encouraged, and I was like, oh, wow, this is good, so I can treat everybody.
But then you
then I realize I'm presenting $500,000 a month and I'm getting accepted like 20%. Who am I getting in here that is not qualified to come from the beginning? Like, who am I getting? So the qualification that, like you said, going over how long have you not seen a dentist? And if it's a few years, then I'm sorry. All the problems that you're saying, it needs to be addressed on that phone where, hey, we're here to help you because if you're taking the time from the dentist, that needs to be like, it's so critical, all of this, like I said, the team, and then I'm learning this, and I'm sorry, I kind of took a little bit more than I wanted, but I'm also learning this as I am third year building my practice from the scratch in the heart of Nashville, which is a very competitive area from in between all of these specialists, and have to be different, right? Like I created this and I'm learning, and these are some of the things I felt like from even for your book, because that co-diagnosis, I created my whole consult room based on that co-diagnosis, because I read this before I opened the office. Consult room was like, how, remember how I built it? Yeah. Like, how do you do it?
And
you did
it. I copied mine off yours.
And he copied, and I'm like, the next thing I come, he's like, he's got a consult room. But the whole idea was, hey, let's get on a table. Let's look at your problems in a setting where it's not me looking over you or like, oh, open up. Yep. And oh, it's going to be $5,000. You got a lot of problems. No, let's sit down, give him some water, chill. And then let's get in that mindset of, hey, I'm here as a clinician, I'm actually not going to be presenting any money because that's not what I do, but I have so-and-so to present it. And I feel like with that type of coordination and an organized system,
it's working.
It is. I mean, it's going to be better, hopefully, with after a few months.
I think you're totally right. The intake phone call is so important to the whole process. Yeah.
Dr. Spear, so when you let's kind of pan now and pivot a little bit. Let's talk about the whole education center and kind of how that began. And I mean, that is, I mean, I have someone who's been now, I guess, to three of the workshops and coming back for implant ROS course in August. How did that all begin?
Yeah, how did that education center?
I'll go back. So John Coyes and I were doing all these study clubs. I think we maxed out at like 13, probably in 1988.
Wow. And, yeah, that's when I was born.
we decided the balance was, we were too far out of balance. So we decided to quit the study club model and do a small teaching center at our office. And that we would then do lectures at hotel courses in Seattle. And then if people wanted to do what we used to do in study clubs, they would actually come to our office instead of us going to their offices. So that was, I think, 89 that happened. And we called it, the name of the business back then was CRE, Creating Restorative Excellence. And so we ran that business together for, I guess, 6 years. And then I had been living in Seattle since 83 because I thought I would always practice in Seattle. And the commute is from my house, where my house was in Seattle, to our office was over an hour each way.
Uh-oh.
And finally, I decided by early 1990s that commuting over 2 hours a day was just not fun. So I moved and opened a new office downtown Seattle in 95. I put in a small teaching center that could do 12 students there. And I started going on the road and doing seminars. So I do seminars in Orlando, Boston, Chicago, New Orleans, Vegas. So I would do 8 to 10 seminars a year. And then we would start doing workshops in my office. And that business, and then I was obviously practicing at the same time. Bob Winter, who superb prosthodontist technician, was in practice with me. And my teaching business really took off probably 2001. So suddenly by the early 2000s, I was doing 18 to 20 workshops a year. I was doing 10 seminars a year. I was practicing 3 days a week. And because of the class size was 12, we ended up getting booked about 2 years out before a student could get in. Wow. Not a good problem. Yeah. So anyway.
Mark me down for 2022.
Exactly. Not a good problem. So about 2007, fast forward, I'm still doing my thing. And I don't know if you know the name Mercer Advisors.
Yeah.
Okay, so Mercer Advisors was a financial consulting group that worked with dentists and their finances and retirement plans. Back then, they were based out of Santa Barbara. I originally started Eugene, Oregon by Rick Mercer, then moved to Santa Barbara. And Imtiaz Manji and Glenn Weisel and a couple other people were the partners that owned Mercer.
Huh.
And Imtiaz's wife was sick, and they moved to Scottsdale so she could be treated at the Mayo Clinic. And ultimately, she ended up passing away. But while the time he was there, he really got the idea that Scottsdale would be a great destination for dentists to come for education.
Spot on. Yep.
And
DIA conference.
So he and the Mercer folks decided to plan this facility, what you now see as Spear Education.
Gotcha.
And so they created the facility to bring in dentists for clinical education. But at the time they built the facility, they actually didn't have any clinical educators. And so they They went on a search.
If you build it, they will come, right?
Yeah. They went on a search looking for people, and ultimately things didn't go quite as well as they had hoped, and they had it running for a couple of years. And I had never met them, and they knew that I was doing well with my educational thing out of Seattle. And they approached me in 07 and said, would you consider moving your educational business to Scottsdale? And it was nothing I would ever have considered in my life, to be honest. But the more we met and talked about it, and at that same time, Mercer, the company, ended up being sold. And so MTLS and Glenn stayed with the teaching facility because they took the teaching facility over, and Mercer went a different way. And so it was just Glenn and MTOZ who came to me and said, hey, would you? So we signed June 26th of 2008 when we signed our agreement. And here we are 11 years later. It's June, right?
That is crazy.
That's amazing. Now, I wanted you said it very quickly, and I want to make sure. So in 89, where you started doing the more of the seminars and things, what exactly were you teaching at that time from your experience from doing perioperosis to this? Because you said you're going to Orlando one weekend, workshops. What exactly you're taught, like teaching, and how has it changed over the years?
Or has it changed much?
You know, it's changed for sure. When I meet somebody who's not a dentist and they hear what I do, they say, oh, so you're teaching the latest techniques. And it's like, well, part of that's true, yes. But in reality, what we're also really doing is, you know, I would say the dean when I was a dental student at Washington was one of the more honest deans I've ever heard. Our first day in dental school, he said, our goal for you is when you walk out of dental school, you'll be a safe beginner. Yeah. And that's the beginning of your education. Mm-hmm. And your education should never stop from that day forward. Right. And so what we teach really, and what I've always taught is what's current, mm-hmm. but then there's also always the fundamentals.
Correct.
The treatment planning, occlusion, those kinds of things in a lot of ways have stayed somewhat constant, not totally, but somewhat constant. And then you have all the new stuff, whether it's materials, whether it's technology. I mean, realize that, you know, when I got out of grad school, we didn't even have implants in the U.S. yet. We didn't even have OSU integrated implants yet.
Sure.
Matter of fact, we didn't have light cured composite in the U.S. till 1979. We had UV cured composite. So it was a different era.
Wow.
So
I'm glad I missed that.
Yeah.
May not have been as into it.
What we taught back then was a lot of treatment planning, a lot of occlusion, and then always new, whatever was new and current. So I used to do a seminar called Aesthetic Techniques and Materials. Mm-hmm. It was an update.
One of the things, like, I wanted to mention this because I know how important, and based on you going there solely right now, and I finishing up course, I'm a graduate now after 2.5 years, I finally finished. But what I also saw with both of you guys, because the mindset, the philosophy, what you just said is what I really like to mention for a lot of folks to understand. What he said is very much true about the fundamentals.
My foundation changed completely when I came back from FGTP.
But after seeing what he's teaching, like, because he started in 89, but he really took off in 2001 and 2, like you said, and then 8 is when he actually had this. But the whole concept of it is a lot of dentists getting out and they want to do these luxury and technique aesthetic stuff when they don't know the fundamentals and the basics, and they get into so much trouble because they mess up cases where now their implants, I don't want implants because it's dangerous, or sinus lift is not for me, or perio is not for me. But because they really don't know what's going on with the basics, they are like, they're trying 30 years of their lives, especially some of these older dentists that I look at and like, what are you doing?
Because they never found the foundation.
And you cannot even begin to tell them this because they never really stopped, or they didn't really, after dental school, they stopped learning.
Yep. Yeah.
And their education is from the 80s and 90s and even early 2000, which, like you said, is if you don't know the fundamentals, it's so important. And that's not the shiny things, right? Like, no. Nobody really likes to, you, like in occlusion class, I remember myself personally, that was my, I hated occlusion. Like, just tell me buckle of what I was even making B-U-L-L, buckle of upper, lower of, like, make these acronyms. Yeah. Don't tell me what, just tell me what I need for tomorrow. Give me the exam. And then I graduate. And I'm like, man, every mistake, every failure, everything goes back to how I messed up from the diagnosis, from the treatment planning. And that's what I wanted to bring up in a way that if anybody really wants to learn, This is why you need to go to these people and these places. And that's why I wanted to mention this. So, yeah,
that's a good point.
Yeah, the fundamentals, I mean, so when you talk about what's changed versus what's the same, the fundamentals really haven't changed radically in terms of what we teach. But certainly a lot of, you know, you mentioned earlier when we started about technology, certainly technology changes in some ways how we do things. How, well, you know, instead of making algorithmic impressions, you're taking scans. Instead of cornerstone models, you're printing models. And
saving time.
You know, there's a bunch of things that technology does that are efficient, but technology really doesn't, for most day-to-day procedures, it doesn't change treatment planning.
Correct.
Technology changes treatment planning when you start talking about cone beam and implant placement and surgery and things like that, because we didn't have that years ago. And so that's a radically different way to look at and treatment plan than off of an old two-dimensional radiograph like we did for years. But a lot of the what the dentists really come for is fundamentals. It's that even
I love the concepts you coined. I think you coined it, facially generated treatment planning. And even with the implants, the more I learn, going back to, like, with even with the 3D and the technology, it's still the same. Like, the
face to the face. Absolutely.
So even no matter how many in sequence guide you're going to go, rows or chromes and all of these you want to do, it goes back to where's the lip line?
Where is
the central? Where is the lateral? Like, all of that is what dictates the technologies, and that's why we want our listeners, dental students especially, because they don't want to have this mindset. When you get out, technology is not going to make you a better dentist. It's going to help, but you got to learn the fundamentals, and a lot of it with technology you can get access to. No, quicker.
You're exactly right. Well, Dr. Spear, I wanna respect your time. Yeah. So we're gonna wrap up here quickly. We may have to.
We need to have him for sure. Because I feel like there's so much cool. We go from
gotten to digital dentistry,
Playboy magazine, that how it started, to like 2008, and still have a lot.
We haven't talked much about implants, but look. Okay, so here's. I want to wrap it up with this. I have a question, and I'm sure Perry has a question too. My question is, I have two questions. If you'll give me two questions, that'd be great. My first question is, I'll give you both of them and let you respond. My first question is, what one piece of advice would you go back and tell a young Dr. Frank as he's graduating residency? Maybe what would you do differently? And then my second question is, we are super pumped because both of us are starting and joining a Spear study club with our periodontist, orthodontist, and eight other dentists. There'll be, I think, 11 or 12 of us.
Nashville, Tennessee. So I mean, you need to maybe do a country visit, country club. Like we
done. I actually really do. I like Nashville a lot.
Yes, well, come you on. Need to have him. Maybe next time we do it in person in a setting. Well, yeah,
I don't know if we can afford it in person.
I don't know.
Try. No, but yes. But my question though is, for a group of young doctors, all you know, the specialists in the group are they're young in their career. We're young in our career. Yeah. We are super excited about kind of joining to do this for a long time together. What's the one piece of advice you would give us as a group as well?
It's a great
question. Those are my two questions.
Yeah. So I'll answer the first one, which was what would I do differently or what advice would I give myself? I would have paid a lot more attention, believe it or not, to the money and profitability aspect from the beginning of practice.
The business side.
Right.
All
right.
I was so focused on just being the absolute best clinician I could be. And I was convinced that people that focused on business and dentistry, they weren't going to be good clinicians. And so I went the other direction and I paid a big emotional price there those first few years for not paying attention.
You know, really, you've kind of mentioned that. That's a big thing you're doing right now.
Yeah, I'm
pivoting from that.
I wasted so much, I feel like, time. But what you also, what I'm thinking, what he's saying is like he could have done what he's done in 2000, early like 2000, have the same amount where he spent a lot of time doing a lot of things that he could have done differently. Is that correct? Like the profitability was not one of the four things you were having probably early on, as you
mentioned. I guess I'm telling the story earlier, I haven't mentioned it, but my problem was that when I was working in that small town, I was getting to do a decent amount of dentistry on cases that came in. But the team was used to the my senior dentist, who he was fine if the patients paid $20 a month. Because back then, an amalgam was $35. A crown was like, $100 and something. Back in the 70s.
Wow. You just had patients paying when they felt like paying.
Yeah. And so my problem was I had a team that wasn't collecting money. Wow. And it was probably, I guess, July of 84, summer of 84, that I was so stressed by money. I actually went to a financial planner and said, I don't know if I can continue to practice dentistry. The stress level is going to come.
Wow.
And I said, is there something I can do that you see that, how am I going to get rid of this stress or get out of dentistry? And he looked at me and he says, you're not getting out of dentistry. You got too much debt. And he says, you're screwed.
So, go back. You got to try harder.
You know what? Once we bought the practice or the building, and then I hired a receptionist who was superb at collecting money. She still works for me. She's worked for me now 33 years.
Wow.
As soon as we started collecting money.
See, that tells you something.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, dentistry was fun.
No.
All of a sudden, the stress went away, and the patients sitting in the chair were actually paying me, and it was like they want to be there. And, I'll never forget it. When I the person I ended up hiring, her name is Debbie. And quick little aside. So she worked for me for 2 weeks, and she had worked at probably the best perio practice in Seattle for years as their receptionist, and they had a cash practice. And so she came into my little town because she was going to marry somebody who was right next door in the town next door to mine. So she didn't want to commute to Seattle. And so she works for me for 2 weeks, and she's a real strong personality. And at the end of the second week, it was Thursday night, we're finishing the day, and she says, you and I need to talk. And she sat me down at a table, and she looked across the table at me, and she says, you're pathetic. And I looked at her, and I was like, probably. She says, you work harder than any dentist I've ever met, but you are so unhappy. She says, why do you do this? Why do you work so hard for these people and they're not paying you? She says, I looked at your books. I had about 9 months of production on the books sitting in accounts receivable.
Oh, my gosh.
And she says, you're miserable. She says, your dentistry is beautiful, but you're miserable. Mm-hmm. And she said, if you want me to be your receptionist and work here, starting Monday, people have to pay their bills.
Wow.
And I said, Debbie, I said, if you ask people to pay their bills and to bring a check, we're going to lose half of this practice.
Right.
This and she said, so what? They don't pay.
And I thought, moment.
Wow. Never thought of it that way. And my joke is for all of us, people change sometimes just because the pain gets great enough. And the pain was great enough. And I said to her, okay, go ahead, call them and tell them they need to bring a check.
Yeah.
And I'll be darned, Monday morning, people brought checks, but about 40% of the practice left in the next 6 months.
Man.
And I was having so much fun and making so much more money.
Wow.
And not stressed because I wasn't working 12-hour days and not getting paid. And it's like, so for me, the lesson to the young me, I wished I had had that focus from the day I got out of school. Great.
But so you were so clinically relevant and you didn't pay attention. You didn't have the time to learn about the business. So that's kind of like me, but I lost $180,000.
That's what I'm saying.
I was the same with doing four hours for free. And next thing you know, I'm like, wait, are these people actually paying? I'm like, oh, well, yeah, we filed insurance. Well, I'm like, you're just not going to pay $40,000. So I was like talking to the walls.
That's great advice.
That was actually great. I think because of how many people also feel the stress and they don't know why they did this. So I think this was a single
To your point, they feel like it's selfish to worry about money. And it's not.
No. You can't help more people because it's selfish to think of it is that you're only helping five instead of millions. Look at what he's done from the 83 that he decided to not even do dentistry to like 2019 that his name is like all over the map in the dental world, right?
All right, so next question.
Study club. So what I would tell you is I'll give you a story about my first study club I ever belonged to.
Okay.
I love this story.
So in 1983, a fellow named Ralph O'Connor, who's a general practitioner in Tacoma, and Ralph and his partner, Dick Klein, were actually probably the two of, if not the biggest practice management speakers in all of dentistry in the 1960s and 70s. So they traveled around teaching dentists four-handed dentistry. And, you know, back then for years, dentists, right, you stood up and you worked with, you know, sometimes by yourself. And they were teaching, you know, expanded function hygiene, multiple operatories, see more than one patient at a time. And they were killing it because dentists had a lot of patients who had a lot of caries. So what happened for Ralph, though, is he realized in his practice, there was a bunch of patients he couldn't treat that way. And he was just kind of sticking them in his recall system, like making a pile of them. And finally, in the early 80s, he decided, you know what, I got to do something for these people that I don't know what to do because I don't know how to treat them. So he called himself, and then there was eight of us that were specialists. And he called us into a meeting. He didn't say why. He just, I want you all to show up at this meeting. So we all show up at this meeting, and he said, here's my vision. My vision is all of you and I are going to form a study club. And the purpose of the study club is so you can help me treat these patients because I don't know what to do.
Wow.
And
that's interesting. That
when you're in this study club with me, you are no longer specialists. I am going to call you limited because that's what you are. You are limited. Things. Now comes the part of the story that would be my suggestion for you and your study club.
Yes.
All right.
What he did, and you'll have to figure out how it's going to work for you.
Sure.
But what he did is he would bring in the records from one or two patients to a study club meeting. Now, we're going to be, for your cases, we're providing documentation.
Exactly.
But he would bring in these records. He would put it up on the screen and he'd pass around models and radiographs. And then he would turn to the orthodontist and he'd say, okay, orthodontist, tell me what you see in these records and tell me how you think. And the rest of you, you're not allowed to speak.
Wow.
And then the orthodontist would finish talking. And then he'd go to the endodontist. Okay, endodontist, we had two endodontists. Tell me what you see in these records and what you think. Nobody else is allowed to speak.
Oh, we got to
skip. Okay, pediatric dentist. He did that as a way of all of us getting to hear how different specialties saw the world of dentistry.
That's great.
Wow. So the reason my treatment planning got developed is I got to spend every month hours with a Vince Kokich, the orthodontist, Dave Matthews, periodontist, the endodontist, pediatric dentist, the oral surgeons, suddenly hearing how they saw dentistry. And it was so different than how I saw dentistry. Because I had a restorative background. That was my focus. So what I would encourage you to do is in study clubs, there's always a tendency for some people to be a little bit more introvert, a little bit quieter, other people to be a little bit more dominant. I would encourage you to at least try. And if somebody doesn't want to talk yet because they're not comfortable, that's great.
Sure.
But I would encourage you to try and sort of monitor to give everybody a chance to have input. if in some section of the meetings,
yeah,
because it will keep people engaged.
That's a great advice.
And you will learn.
Yeah.
We'll get to learn stuff that otherwise you wouldn't get to learn.
Well, and you then, I mean, for me, I'm excited because, I mean, that's a huge.
And it's free.
To get to, well, it's not free for months.
No, I mean, it's free to learn. I mean, all of this stuff that you gain with all the access, I feel like it's free.
Are you saying from the knowledge of the specialist?
Right, yeah. Like, because you're not going to speaking, like, or you're not going to weekend courses and you're not taking the action.
Well, and then, I mean, we get to cherry pick. It's fantastic to pick their brains and see their sides.
And then they're going to tell you, oh, by the way, I did
it'll make us better dentists.
Right. And also, like, I feel like they're going to tell you a lot of things that, oh, by the way, this case I've done and this is what happens with these Indo, for example. I feel like most of my great conversation comes from Indo because they're thinking, I always like to have Indo as the first primary, like you want to save it. But then I talk to a lot of endodontists and they also tell me that now, right now, they have a lot more, like for example, retreats, like they're even not going for and they want to have a
conversation.
So it is great to have that communication and being so close with the specialists, especially the local community.
Oh, I can't wait. It's gonna be a blast.
Meister. It's gonna be.
You got any last things for
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Like I said, I love the whole thing.
It's been fun.
Yeah, solely did.
I have a question for you guys.
Okay, oh, yeah. Yes, please.
So I want to know what age range qualifies to be a millennial.
So it got debatable because, you know, I mean, we have to be very selective.
It's more spiritual.
It's an inner thing.
I honestly feel like he's more millennial than a lot of millennials.
To be clear, we don't live in our parents' basement. We are a little entitled, probably, but you know it
spoiled.
Is okay.
I'm spoiled.
According to Wikipedia, it's 82. So 82 and up is you have to be born after 82 to qualify as millennial.
But he graduated 82.
So he graduated.
That's
so that kind of qualifies you as a born. You were reborn as a dentist. You're a millennial.
I'll tell you one of the reasons I was asking. So I have three children.
Okay.
Nice.
The oldest daughter is 38. Her husband's an endodontist.
Okay.
So he's just outside, I guess.
Yep, Gen Xer.
The middle daughter is a general practitioner here in Seattle area. She's 37, so she was born in 82.
She's a borderliner.
And then my youngest son actually is a first-year dental student. Well, second-year dental student. He just started his second year at the University of Washington this week on Monday. So.
Oh, wow. So he's probably much more like us. That's awesome.
No, this is good because I feel like also you've stayed so young and you've stayed so current because of also your offsprings and having the children around. And I think that's also part of joy of what he's doing and being a part of dentistry. Because
it's fun. It's fun and frustrating to watch their struggles.
Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine all the frustration they have because they have to carry on such a think about. I mean, oh my god, I don't even want to.
I'll tell you my story. You know, it's funny you say, you know, talking about, you know, staying young and staying relevant and working, and you know it's cool, and I think you'll appreciate this. You know, my dad had a super successful practice, you know, been doing this for 30 years, love what he did, but you know, you bring in some new energy, some new ideas, you know, you kind of throw it up a little bit, and obviously being father son, it's been awesome to get to work together. But his thing now is, you know, he says, he jokes, he goes, you know, I've never had more fun, I've never made more money, and never worked harder. I think that's pretty cool though, you know, for a 56, 57 year old to say about what, you know, what they're doing in their career. Yeah. So it's cool. Yeah. It's a cool time to be a dentist.
It is actually. I agree completely.
Well, Dark Spirit, thank you so much for your time. Enjoy the rest of your week and we'll talk soon. And hopefully we can do this again for sure.
If I'm ever in Nashville, I'll look you up.
Yes, please do. We'd love to have you. Right. This is going to be so much more fun.
I'd be happy to do this again with you sometime in the future.
Yes. Thank you so much, Doc. This has been amazing.
Everybody work smarter, not harder. We'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks you guys.
Thanks, Doc. Have a good night.
Yep. You too.
Thank you, Doc.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.